From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. In The Terminator, it was a woman against a robot assassin played by Arnold Schwarzenegger. In Aliens, it was Sigourney Weaver versus a planet full of vicious monsters. This time, in The Abyss, the suspense and terror take place at the bottom of the ocean. On today's Fresh Air, screenwriter and director James Cameron talks about his movies. Also today, Kenan Ivory Wayans discusses his send-up of the black exploitation films of the 70s. I'm Gonna Get You, Sucka is just out on video. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a collection of music commissioned for the Ballet Russe from Eric Satie and Francis Poulenc. And commentator Patsy McLaughlin wonders why anyone would want to wear clothes with the Batman logo. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Michael Richards. U.S. and Panamanian forces are engaged in a series of tit-for-tat seizures of each other's personnel. NPR's Neil Conan brings us up to date on the latest in an escalating round of confrontations.
The incident occurred at Fort Amador, a joint U.S.-Panamanian facility that was built to defend the Pacific end of the Panama Canal. This morning, an American MP was arrested by Panamanian forces inside the fort. U.S. sources say they don't know why. Then a second soldier sent to track down the first was also arrested. Mercedes Morris, a spokeswoman for the U.S. Southern Command, says that U.S. troops then exercised their responsibility for the security of Fort Amador, bringing five armored personnel carriers up to the only entrance to the fort. In the process, she said, two members of the Panamanian Defense Forces were required to surrender their weapons. They were released at the same time the two American MPs were let go. Several more minor incidents of harassment by Panamanian forces were also reported in Panama City today. They follow an incident outside the capital yesterday when U.S. troops detained nine Panamanian soldiers and 20 civilians for about 2.5 hours. This is Neil Conan in Washington.
President Bush today signed the bill to bail out the nation's failing savings and loans. As NPR's Julie McCarthy reports, the legislation completely restructures the way the thrift industry is regulated.
The legislation signed today is the most sweeping reform of the SNL oversight process since its regulatory agencies were created during the New Deal. Gone is the Federal Savings and Loan Insurance Corporation, which insures deposits at thrifts, taken over by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, or FDIC, which insures deposits at commercial banks. Analysts say the restructuring will strengthen and streamline oversight. The bill is also the costliest bailout in the country's history, providing billions of dollars to liquidate ailing SNLs and pay back depositors. At a White House ceremony signing the bill into law, President Bush acknowledged the legislation is not without flaws.
And no, the bill is not perfect, but it is a first step, a crucial step, toward restoring public confidence.
Estimates of the cost of the bailout to taxpayers range from $100 billion to $240 billion over the next decade. I'm Julie McCarthy in Washington.
It's being called a suicide attack. A truck bomb slammed into an Israeli convoy today in South Lebanon, leaving at least five Israeli soldiers dead. A radio station with close links to the Hezbollah movement said it was a payback for Israel having seized the Shiite cleric Sheikh Obeid. In Washington, President Bush today said that while the U.S. government is willing to talk to anyone about the hostage situation, he reiterated U.S. policy that there will be no deals for hostages or anything that looks like a trade, because it will just encourage terrorists to take more hostages. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average closed down 13.9 today to finish at 2686.08. This is NPR News. In a move that many will view as a setback for President Bush's clean air proposals, a consortium of eight northeastern states will announce plans tomorrow to move beyond the planned auto emission standards. Paul Eisenstein reports.
Since the Clean Air Act went into effect back in 1970, California has had the toughest automotive emission standards in the country. And in 1993, the regulations will be tightened even more. In fact, they'll be substantially stricter than those being offered by President Bush as part of the proposed federal update of the Clean Air Act. With that in mind, a coalition of the six New England states, plus New York and New Jersey, plan to adopt the California auto standards beginning in 1993. Thomas Jorling, New York's Commissioner of Environmental Conservation, says the president was willing to trade off health concerns for political considerations.
It's clear that people should quit dilly-dallying and build a clean, durable car, because building a clean, durable car is economically and technically feasible.
auto industry officials say they're concerned about the East Coast plan, which they insist is not the best way to solve air quality problems. For National Public Radio, I'm Paul Eisenstein in Detroit.
A convicted murderer is holding three hostages at gunpoint in a South Carolina prison. Officials at the McCormick Correctional Institution in the town of McCormick say the inmate has three demands: to see a lawyer, to talk to his wife, and to see his prison record. Officials rejected all of them. Two more liquor salesmen testified today that the tax evasion and extortion trial of New York hotel Queen Leona Hemsley, and both said that they were required to give kickbacks. Earlier, another liquor salesman testified that the only way he could get lucrative contracts from the hotel chain was to turn part of his commission over. Today, the two salesmen said the kickbacks were arranged by a top aide to Leona Hemsley, Frank Turco, but that after Turco was fired, the kickback demands stopped. A researcher for the Agriculture Department says that farmers may soon be able to select the gender of livestock before they're born. Although the research involved rabbit sperm, it could work for other animals. I'm Michael Richards in Washington.
This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. My guest James Cameron makes action films. He co-wrote Rambo 2 and co-wrote and directed The Terminator, which starred Arnold Schwarzenegger, and Aliens with Sigourney Weaver. His new movie is the deep-sea thriller The Abyss. The story is set 25,000 feet below the Atlantic. Cameron shot 40% of the film underwater, but not in the ocean. He used two enormous concrete tanks from a partially constructed nuclear power plant in South Carolina. One tank is 55 feet deep and holds 7.5 million gallons of water. With these tanks, Cameron avoided sharks and frigid ocean temperatures, but there were still incredible technical and physical problems to overcome in completing this $43 million film. Cameron adapted the plot from a short story he wrote in high school. A U.S. nuclear submarine is attacked under mysterious circumstances. The Navy recruits the members of a nearby underwater oil drilling crew to lead a search and rescue mission. Ed Harris stars as the foreman of the oil rig, who is reluctant to follow the order.
Don't you guys have your own stuff for this kind of thing?
By the time we get our rescue submersibles here, the storm front will be right on us. Now you can get your rig in under the storm, be on site in 15 hours, and that makes you our best option right now.
Why should we risk our butts for something like this?
I have been authorized to offer you all special bonuses equivalent to 3 times normal dive pay.
Yes, sir. Ooh, buddy!
Yeah. Hell, for triple time, I'd eat beanie.
It set me on fire and put me out with horse feet.
Look, I don't know what kind of deal you guys made with the company, but my people are not qualified for this. We're oil workers.
This is a paycheck.
Shut up! Hold it down.
This is Lieutenant Coffey. He will transfer it down to you with a SEAL team and supervise the operation.
You can send down whoever you like, Commodore, but I'm the tool pusher on this rig, and when it comes to the safety of these people, there's me and then there's God, understand? If things get dicey, I'm pulling the plug.
James Cameron, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much.
When you decided to make The Abyss, did you have any realistic idea of what it would take to do an underwater film?
I had done a little underwater directing.
Oh, Piranha 2, right?
Piranha 2, right, exactly. I did 4 weeks of underwater work in the Cayman Islands, which is where I became familiar with the idea of the Cayman Trough, which is an abyssal trench. And I learned many things about underwater directing, which can be summed up very simply, is that it's incredibly difficult, everything is frustrating and takes longer than you think. So I went in with a kind of foreknowledge that it would be a very difficult endeavor. Unfortunately, I think I was a little optimistic in some of my technical solutions that I thought would solve everything in a panacea-like manner, which proved not to be the case.
Mm-hmm. What would you say was the most risky, the most dangerous scene that you directed? There's a long list here.
There's a pretty long list. You know, we were fighting the obvious danger overall that we had actors with a limited amount of training working underwater. And I would say some of the flooding sequences, which were not the not the full underwater scenes, but the flooding scenes were the more dangerous because water tends to be very unpredictable and it's very massive and it can move a human body around very, very easily. And I was worried about people crashing into set pieces and hurting themselves and possibly being knocked unconscious. And we did a lot of rehearsal and a lot of pre-planning and managed to avoid all problems. There were no injuries in the shoot, and I'm proud of that given the nature of, you know, what we were doing.
Well, you say that the flooding scenes were some of the most difficult. These are scenes where water starts to leak, rush through through an opening or a door in an underwater vessel.
Right.
And I mean, it's not a slow flooding. It's a kind of like rapid surge of water that, as you say, knocks people against walls and so on. How do you do that? Where is the water coming from, and how do you control it?
We built some very large dump tanks, which are big cylindrical tanks that can be rotated rapidly, that are open at the top, and we had 3 8,000-gallon dump tanks. You know, kind of running together, so that we had 24,000 gallons of water that we could dump. And then in a scene where we flood the drill room of the submersible drilling station, we dumped the 24,000 gallons, and then we cut, and then we refilled the tanks, and we dumped another 24,000 gallons into that room, which made a total of 48,000 gallons. And then in a subsequent scene, we opened the hydraulic door from that part of the set into another part of the set, which was a kind of a system of corridors. And so we had the, 48,000 gallons of water coming down that corridor with Ed Harris running in front of it. And it sort of picked him up and swept him along. And it looks very dangerous in the film, but, we were very meticulous about our planning and how we did things. And the entire corridor, even though it's filled with pipes and valves and things, was really made out of foam rubber. So there was really, it was like a Nerf corridor.
So if you get knocked over the head by something, it's just going to be lightweight.
Yeah, there was nothing to hang up on or snag or bruise or bump. And he came through it fine and asked for another take because there was something, he wanted to do it better.
Since the Twilight Zone deaths, I think actors have gotten much more concerned about possible hazards on the set. And I'm sure some of the actors were worried. I mean, I've read quotes from actors saying that they were concerned about their safety during some of the shooting of the film. Mm-hmm. Were there any rebellions on the part of the actors or any serious fears that they expressed to you, reservations about shooting scenes that you had in mind?
Yeah, I think everybody expressed reservations about certain things before the fact, but when it was demonstrated to them, which I think is the most important step, when it was demonstrated to them how it was going to be done, and usually I would do that demonstration myself, saying basically, "Look, you're going to stand here. I'm you're going to do what I'm doing right now," and then I would just do it. And since I'm not a stuntman or an athlete in any way, I would be able to demonstrate to them that we had worked it out, so that it, through the special effects people or the stunt people or whatever, that it was safe to do. And then, having seen that demonstration, they would do it. And, once again, I want to reiterate that out of 140 days of shooting with 8 weeks of underwater shooting, flooding, fires, explosions, and, the like, there were no injuries whatsoever, which, quite frankly, I've never heard of. Your average car chase movie sends people to the hospital.
Mm-hmm. Can you see when you're directing underwater? Can you see well enough to know if one of the actors is giving you a good performance?
Oh, very well. Yeah, absolutely. I was wearing a diving helmet. I could see them very clearly through the faceplates of their helmets. And I also had a video assist system where I could see what the camera was seeing, both A camera and B camera, while we were shooting. I could hear them on my headset, and I could see them. They were usually only 4 or 5 feet away, unless we were doing a long shot where they would walk up to the camera. And so, I really had a pretty good idea exactly what I was getting at all times, just like I would in surface photography.
Mm-hmm. James Cameron is my guest, the director of the new thriller, The Abyss. I think it was Fox, who I guess is distributing the film, did some kind of marketing research study and found that a whole lot of people don't know what the word The Abyss means.
Mm-hmm.
Was it ever suggested you change the title? I mean, what do you do with information like that?
I think my very first meeting with the marketing department, the head of advertising said, how much do you like the title? I said, we're not changing the title. I said, okay. I have faith in the American public's ability to learn two syllables. It's not that difficult a concept.
Is there an underwater solution that you're proudest of, a solution to a problem underwater?
Well, I think that if you embrace the idea of taking actors into the water and taking them down on a diving system of some sort, then you have to solve the problem of seeing their faces, because conventional scuba is horrible. You literally can't recognize people in a medium close-up. just can't recognize them. Their mouths are distorted by the regulator that they have to hold between their teeth, and the face mask kind of distorts the face, and it's just really unsatisfying. Plus, you can't talk, and so there's really no emotion, no drama. So the diving helmet that we developed for this film, I think, solved a lot of those problems. It made it possible to take actors under the surface of the water and still do very dramatic and very emotional moments and capture their, you know, their expressions and their dialogue and so on. And that, to me, I think, would be the biggest technical solution that we came up with. Otherwise, it would have all been pointless. The whole idea of taking them down there, you know, with us would have been pointless. We could have done it with doubles and, you know, punched in for a couple of close-ups shot in a swimming pool, which is pretty much how it's always been done. And it would have been equally satisfying. You know, my contention going in was that that's not satisfying. That if you're going to hypothesize that these are our characters, then we want to see them. We want to hear them.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of like the technical breakthrough that I think made the film worth doing.
Well, I want to talk more about your movies, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is film director James Cameron. His new underwater thriller is called The Abyss, and it opens this week. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
James Cameron is my guest, director of the new film The Abyss. He also co-wrote and directed Aliens, which starred Sigourney Weaver, and The Terminator, which featured Arnold Schwarzenegger as a cyborg assassin. Cameron also wrote the screenplay for Rambo First Blood Part 2. Most of the films that I know of that you've made, all of the films I know of that you've made, have been action films. And I wonder what interests you most about that genre.
Well, I don't think of action as a genre. I think of action as something that can be incorporated in films in different genres,
uh-huh.
whether it be science fiction or a contemporary action adventure, you know, to a you know, a period piece with action. To me, action is a you know, cinema at its purest and rawest and most viscerally affecting, and you know, I just enjoy the craftsmanship. The craft of doing action sequences, which is not to say that I think every film needs an action sequence or that every film that I do will be action-oriented. It's just something that I like to do.
Terminator was your thriller, which starred Arnold Schwarzenegger mm-hmm. as a robot-like a cyborg from mm-hmm. from the future, mm-hmm. who's sent back to the present to kill a woman, and then Michael Biehn starred as somebody else from the future who's sent back to save her from Schwarzenegger.
Right.
Let's hear a clip from the film.
All right, listen. The Terminator's an infiltration unit, part man, part machine. Underneath, it's a hyperalloy combat chassis, microprocessor controlled, fully armored, very tough, but outside, it's living human tissue. Flesh, skin, hair, blood grown for the cyborgs.
Look, Reese, I don't know what you want.
Pay attention! I gotta ditch this car. The 600 series had rubber skin. We spotted them easy. But these are new. They look human. Sweat, bad breath, everything. Very hard to spot. I had to wait till he moved on you before I could zero him.
Look, I am not stupid, you know. They cannot make things like that yet.
Not yet. Not for about 40 years.
Are you saying it's from the future?
One possible future. From your point of view, I don't know tech stuff.
Then you're from the future too, is that right?
Right.
Right.
That clip was interesting. It's an interesting approach to exposition. Tell the whole story during a car chase.
Yeah, that's right.
So that you don't realize you're listening to 2.5 pages of expository dialogue.
Yeah, they even change cars in the middle.
Yeah, exactly, right.
Of the scene. So that was conscious to kind of bury the exposition in an action scene.
Sure, you always feel that big chunk of exposition kind of sticking in your craw while you're writing and you're trying to think of some creative way to deal with it so that the audience can get the information but not feel that the whole story, you know, is grinding to a halt.
Arnold Schwarzenegger seems like a very inspired choice to play someone who isn't even really a man. because he's just so unnatural looking, being as muscular as he is and being, right, in a way as stiff as he is. I thought it was a really terrific performance. It was a lot of fun. Was it your idea to cast him in that? Did you have him in mind when you wrote it?
Well, no, I didn't have him in mind when I wrote it at all. In the writing, I actually visualized the Terminator as someone who would fade into a crowd, and only when the camera kind of lingered on that person in close-up did you really see this kind of sort of cold, blank malevolence. What happened was Arnold was proposed for Michael Biehn's character. And I had never met Arnold, and I knew from, you know, having written the script that it probably wasn't something that Arnold was ready to do as an actor yet, because it was a lot of, you know, it was page after page after page of very, you know, intense dramatic dialogue. And all I'd seen him do at that point was Conan. I didn't know if he had developed enough as an actor. But I had lunch with him just, you know, because I was interested in him as this persona. And while we were talking, and he'd read the script, and he was very enthusiastic about the script. He really has an eye for material that he should be involved in. And all he could talk about was the Terminator character. Not that he was proposing himself, but that those were the moments that were the most interesting to him or most memorable. And as he was talking, I was thinking to myself, he would make a hell of a Terminator. I'm sitting there watching him. I didn't even hear what he was saying, thinking, you know, with his face and his overall presence. And I went back and proposed that to John Daly at Hemdale, and Daly called up and made the deal, and we were set. We were off that afternoon.
Does it cause any problems to know that the cyborg assassin, the Terminator, is going to have a German accent? That's not the kind of thing you feel you have to explain away in a script.
Well, possibly in the time travel process, one of his chips got scrambled a little bit. I mean, the concept, if you accept the idea on the scripted page that he was meant to be an infiltration unit who could pass seamlessly for a normal person, and was being sent on a mission, and they knew that the target city was Los Angeles, 1984, then I think he was probably not a very good choice. But I don't think anybody ever really slowed down to analyze that. And obviously there was nothing we could do about it. It just seemed to work. It seems to work at some level. Maybe it evokes some sense of, German stormtrooper kind of feeling or something.
Well, you've worked with America's two leading strong men superstars, Schwarzenegger in The Terminator, and Sylvester Stallone in Rambo 2. You, mm-hmm, what, co-wrote the screenplay for Rambo 2?
Yeah, a very different relationship on that film. You know, on The Terminator, you know, I wrote the script, and Arnold was, at that time, as an actor, he was more of a supplicant. He wanted to learn. He wanted to expand himself in a new area. And it wasn't an area that he was dominating. Working with Sly was really quite the opposite. And actually, the order was opposite as well. I actually worked on Rambo before directing Terminator. And in that case, I was more of the supplicant. I was a writer that needed a job. And I offered them, you know, two or three drafts of a script for First Blood 2, as we called it at the time. And I never really worked, you know, sort of cheek by jowl with Sly, you know, under a light at the kitchen table late at night, you know, like you might visualize the writing team working. He took those drafts and took from them what he wanted and compiled his own.
For a lot of critics of the movie, Rambo 2 kind of epitomized the lack of concern for human life in some adventure films, and the lack of concern for characterization with depth. How does it make you feel hearing, you know, a film that you had a hand in writing criticized by so many people?
I only think that you can take responsibility when you have control. I had no control over that picture once I created scenes that were very psychologically intense, that the character had a very strong foundation. There was a regard. There was much more of a kind of a moral dilemma proposed in terms of the violence, and all that stuff was examined. And he was much more of a tormented soul, which is kind of a character that I recreated for myself in terms of Ripley for Aliens. And none of that really made it to the screen. You know, they just kind of went for the straight up action. Mm-hmm. And that's okay. You know, I mean, that was that film, but it's not a film that I would have wanted to direct, you know, in that sense. In fact, at one point they even asked me if I wanted to direct it, and I was planning to do Terminator at that point, and so I declined.
Do you try to see your movies with real audiences?
Yeah, always.
What's the audience reaction to a scene that surprised you most?
I think there was some humor in the Terminator, or the Terminator was interpreted humorously in scenes that I didn't think were particularly funny.
Such as?
I don't know. Just some moments during some of the shootouts, which I probably took fairly seriously when I was doing it, that seemed to play larger than life for an audience. And I think to a certain extent, it's not kind of broad laughter, but a nervous laughter based on they just don't believe how outrageous the scene is, and their reaction must be laughter. And I learned a lot about how to interpret audience reaction and when laughter is good and when it's bad from that film.
Uh-huh. When is laughter bad?
Well, meaning when inappropriate laughter is bad and when laughter that I haven't predicted is actually good, meaning that it releases tension. I found that it is possible in a film to build up tension for so long that people need a release, and a line of dialogue or a situation will hit them funny in a way that it wouldn't have hit them funny if they hadn't had 15 minutes of white knuckling right before it. You build up a physiological reaction to the tension that you're feeling watching a film, and you have to release it, and laughter is the way to do that. So I tried to incorporate that in my writing from that point on, to create little safety valves for people to blow off steam.
The Abyss opens this week, and mm-hmm. I've already seen several articles talking about, you know, how expensive the film was, mm-hmm, how it's mm-hmm. opening later mm-hmm. than was initially intended, and how right. important it is that it make back the money that it made. It's, what, $43 million budget?
Yeah, $43 million.
What's your involvement with that now? I know the studio has a lot riding on it financially now. Your uh-huh. work is done.
You've
made the movie.
I've made the film.
Where is your mind now? Is it in worrying about whether this film will make back its money, or are you already thinking ahead to your next movie?
Well, I'm not thinking ahead to my next film. I kind of want to see the outcome. To me, the money is just a gauge of whether people are going to see the film and whether you know, a large number of people are getting something out of the film.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, the money is very important to the studio because that's business. You know, I can take an artistic stance and say that it doesn't matter to me because I did the film that I wanted, and, you know, here it is. But you do have to be pragmatic and say that, you know, it's always nicer if you can make the people who backed you and who had faith in you happy and have it be a good experience for them as well. So obviously I hope that the film is successful, and I think, you know, every filmmaker hopes that.
So now that The Abyss is finished, will you be doing any deep sea diving on your next vacation?
Yeah, sure. I want to go on a vacation. I want to go diving.
You really do?
Mm-hmm. Sure. I love diving.
Okay. James Cameron, thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
James Cameron's new film, The Abyss, opens this week. It stars Ed Harris, Michael Biehn, and Mary Ellen Mastrantonio. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with political columnists Jack Drummond and Jules Whitcover. They've covered national politics and presidential campaigns for 30 years. They've just written a new book about last year's campaign called Whose Broad Stripes and Bright Stars? The Trivial Pursuit of the Presidency, 1988. I hope you can join us.
Starting our descent. Divers, how you doing?
Everybody's okay so far.
Hang on, boys. It's all downhill from here.
Hey, how deep's the drop-off here?
There's a bottomless pit, baby. 2.5 miles straight down.
Cab 3, it's Bud. You online?
Cab 3, check. I'm right behind you.
Cab 1, do you see it yet?
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, platform shoes, gold chains, jive-tucking pimps, and football players turned action heroes. Kenan Ivory Wayans discusses his spoof of black exploitation films of the 70s. His movie, I'm Gonna Get You, Sucka, is just out on video. Patsy McLaughlin wonders why so many people are wearing Batman t-shirts. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new reissue of Music Commissioned for the Ballet Russe. Such composers as Eric Satie, Francis Poulenc, and Darius Milhaud furthered the ballet's reputation for innovation. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Doreen McAllister. A senior administration official says President Bush is expected to name former White House National Security Advisor General Colin Powell as the new chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. The four-star Army general would become the first black to hold the post as the nation's senior military officer. The unidentified source said the White House is expected to make the announcement tomorrow. Upon confirmation by the Senate, Powell will succeed Admiral William Crowe, who is to retire September 30th. President Bush today pledged that he would pursue every diplomatic channel open to him to win the release of the hostages in Lebanon, but he also vowed not to get involved in trading off or negotiating for hostages. Meanwhile, in the Middle East today, a car bomb injured five Israeli soldiers in southern Lebanon, and there were a number of violent incidents in the Israeli-occupied territories. NPR's John Hockenberry has more.
The car bombing took place this morning as a military convoy passed by a pickup truck booby-trapped with more than 300 pounds of explosives. Two men were killed in the attack. Both were inside the pickup. Hezbollah, the pro-Iranian Shiite organization in Lebanon, claimed the car bombing was in retaliation for the kidnapping by Israel of Sheikh Abdul Karim Obeid more than a week ago. In the Gaza Strip, meanwhile, at least two Palestinians were killed in serious anti-Israeli demonstrations. One of the dead was a five-year-old child. And a one-and-a-half-year-old baby was buried on the West Bank today. The Israeli child was killed by army bullets when his father fired into what he thought was a group of Palestinians. It was instead an Israeli army patrol which fired back, killing the baby in a nearby car. The father was a Jewish settler from the West Bank settlement of Ariel. This is John Hockenberry in Jerusalem.
The United States is sending military planes to Ethiopia to reinforce the search for Congressman Mickey Leland's downed aircraft. The Texas Democrat and 13 other people were last seen on Monday when they left the capital of Addis Ababa on their way to a refugee camp. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
The 11 Ethiopian planes that have been searching for Leland have ended their efforts for the day. Ground crews are continuing to look for the plane on foot. Today, the United States sent a medical evacuation plane and crew to Ethiopia. The State Department announced that the Ethiopian government has also given permission for a U.S. U-2 spy plane to make a photo reconnaissance flight over the area. The search for Leland's small twin-engine turboprop has now been widened to include areas inside the border of Sudan. Leland was on his way to a refugee camp near the Sudanese border. He was there to check up on the progress of hunger relief efforts, efforts he feared may have been hampered by a recent coup in Sudan and the influx of more than 800,000 Sudanese refugees into the already overcrowded Ethiopian camps. In Washington, I'm Mara Liasson.
The Dow Jones Industrial Average closed down 13.09 points today to finish the day at 2686.08. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review of two new compact discs of ballet music written by French composers. The five ballets included are all from the 1920s and were written for Serge Diaghilev's Ballet Russe. The conductor is Igor Markevich, who was in Monte Carlo when the ballets were first performed.
For centuries, the Russians have been infatuated with all things French. But between the two world wars, the aspect of French culture that seemed to be most admired by the Russians was not so much the intellectual and philosophical as the decadent, the playful, the escapist. The five ballets by French composers on these discs were first performed by the great Russian dance company, Serge Diaghilev's Ballet Russe, at Monte Carlo. Here, Vaslav Nijinsky and his younger sister Bronislava both danced and choreographed Stravinsky's latest works. George Balanchine choreographed his first great ballets. Artists like Picasso, Braque, and Duran designed the decor. Jean Cocteau contributed story ideas. The composers represented on this album were just beginning their careers, except for the cheeky, iconoclastic Erik Satie, the musical father of them all. Here's a bit of Satie's Jack in the Box, orchestrated by Darius Milhaud and choreographed by Balanchine in 1926, the year after Satie's death. The most famous ballet on this set is Francis Poulenc's Les Biches, composed in 1924 with choreography by Bronislava Nijinska. Like much of Balanchine's work, it's all dance. There's only the hint of a story. The setting is a chic party. In fact, the title, which literally means the does or deer, is sometimes translated into English as the house party. One girl wears a man's blue jacket and tights, not a tutu. The hostess, with a rope of pearls and a long cigarette holder, dances with two athletes. Two young girls have a delicately erotic pas de deux. They kiss shyly, then exit nervously in opposite directions. Les Biches was apparently intended to be a modern parody of Fokine's famous romantic Chopin ballet, Les Sylphides. The other scores are Milhaud's Le Train Bleu, choreographed by Nijinska with the dancers in bathing suits designed by Chanel, and Georges Auric's Les Fachos, The Boars, based on Molière and designed by Braque. The music I was most eager to hear was Henri Sauguet's La Chatte, one of Balanchine's earliest successes. The story is based on the Aesop fable about the man who falls in love with his cat. He prays to Aphrodite, who transforms the cat into a woman. But when a mouse runs across the floor, she chases after it. The young man kills himself in despair. The radical constructivist set, transparent and geometrical, was by Naum Gabo and Antoine Pevsner. These sweetly sardonic performances were originally recorded in 1972 and couldn't be more authoritative. the National Orchestra of the Monte Carlo Opera is conducted by Igor Markevich, Diaghilev's last protege. Later, he married Nijinsky's daughter. His musical compositions never quite survived a review written in 1932, in which Virgil Thompson remarked that Markevich's career was more interesting than his music. His conducting, however, has an affection, delicacy, and sharpness of wit that are irresistible.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor for the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed two new discs called French Musicians of the Russian Ballet. They're on the French Adès label. This is Fresh Air. That's the theme from the film I'm Gonna Get You, Sucker. It spoofs black exploitation films of the 70s like Shaft, Superfly, and Cleopatra Jones. Sucker just came out on home video, and my guest is the film's writer, director, and star, Keenan Ivory Wayans. Wayans co-wrote and co-starred in Robert Townsend's film, Hollywood Shuffle, a satire about black stereotypes in Hollywood. Wayans also co-wrote Eddie Murphy's concert film, Raw. And like Murphy, Wayans began his career as a stand-up comic. We talked first about I'm Gonna Get You, Sucker.
The basic story is about a character named Jack Spade, who is played by myself, who comes home from the army after 10 years and finds out his brother's been killed from an overdose of gold chains. And he decides to do something about it, and he rounds up all of his old heroes, and they go after Mr. Big, who's a big gold distributor in town.
Hey, man, who are we waiting on?
Kung Fu Joe. He'll be here in a minute.
Who is he?
Jack Spade, that new blood I was talking about.
What? Your new blood. You ever kill a man before?
No, but I've been trained to go out.
Hey, man, no way. He's got to get all our asses killed, man. Look at him. He look funny, man. Look how he's looking at us.
Hey, look, man, I can handle myself.
Oh, yeah? Well, what makes you think you can be a black hero?
I'm an ex-football player.
I thought of this as an homage as much as it was a parody. I figured you must have seen a lot of the black exploitation films.
It was exactly that. I lived on those movies. They were, and that was what we did on the weekends. We went down to the theaters with a couple of dollars and saw like three movies and spent the day. So I got a chance to see all those films in their heyday.
One of the retired heroes who gets back into the action after your character says, "Help me find Mr. Big." This character says, "The people said I should retire, that I was too violent, that I was a bad image for the kids." Do you think that that's the rap that black exploitation films got, and do you think that that rap was deserved?
Well, that's the film that is the rap that they got. No, I don't think that it was the rap that they deserved. I think that the term became a blanket term. And it was used to describe almost every film that had a black cast. And what you have in any genre film is good and bad. An example is horror. You have Alfred Hitchcock, which is classic. And then you have Friday the 13th, Part 80, which is basically a formula picture that's slapped together with no real creative integrity, designed to exploit an existing audience. And the same thing happened with films that depicted black life. They had the good ones and they had the bad ones. Shaft is not an exploitation movie. Shaft, as a matter of fact, was a monumental film. I mean, if you look at it, it was the first time a black man had been in a lead that displayed him with any aggression or any sexuality. Secondly, it was the first time that a black director had ever directed a major motion picture for a studio. That was Gordon Parks and MGM. It was also the first time that a black had ever won an Oscar for a score of a film, Isaac Hayes. So that was a great accomplishment. And when we look back, Shaft will be classified as an exploitation movie.
So you think in the attempt to get more positive role models, the opposite happened. There were no blacks on the screen for a long time.
Yeah, I think in the attempt to eliminate the negative, everybody overreacted. And as a result, abandoned the group of films that we had out there that represented us in a very good fashion.
Well, in your film, your character approaches all these former action heroes and brings them out of retirement. You literally did that to make the movie.
You went to Isaac Hayes
and to Jim Brown and to Bernie Casey and asked them to be in your movie. And I was wondering what kind of reactions you got from all of them, telling them that you were going to do this part parody, part homage to the movies that they were in.
Well, everybody who's in the film came on with the same enthusiasm about the movie that I had. They all thought it was funny and all looked at it as a chance to have fun making fun of themselves. There were those that I approached that didn't find it funny.
Your character is asked by one of these retired heroes what makes him think that he could be an action hero, and he says, I used to be a football player. Mm-hmm. Of course, that's a direct reference to Jim Brown who's in the movie. Did he think that was funny, or was he offended by it?
That was the line that made him want to do the movie.
Oh, great.
Yeah, because it epitomized the action films. The image of the black male at that particular time was the large, physically imposing, and very macho black men, and most of them were ex-football players, i.e. Jim Brown, Fred Williamson, Bernie Casey, Rosie Greer, Carl Weathers, you know, all came out of playing football. The transition was into being the action heroes.
Was this a hard production to sell?
When I conceived it, it would have been impossible to sell.
When did you conceive it?
Like 5-6 years ago. But by the time I had written it and decided to take it around, I had already done Hollywood Shuffle and produced Raw. And with those two credits, it made it easier for me to go in and sit down with a studio. And the real difficulty in receiving financing was just convincing the studio that it could be done for the budget that I had proposed, and convinced them that I'd, as a first-time director, be able to handle all of these responsibilities. And that was, I guess, the hardest thing.
When you were taking the screenplay around trying to get money to get it produced and everything, were there any suggestions that in order to really make back the money, you'd need to draw in a white audience too? In order to get a white audience, there'd have to be more white characters or a white sidekick or something like that?
Oh, yeah. That well, one of the suggestions was to have Anthony Michael Hall play my stepbrother and have him act black the entire film. And my response was, I have 60 real black people in the movie. Why have him in there acting black, you know?
Were there any in-jokes that you reluctantly took out?
No.
Good. Okay. You've done some acting outside of your own film. You were in Star 80 and have been in several TV episodes. One of the very funny things in Hollywood Shuffle was a scene black actor school where everybody's trained to act more black.
Right.
And you know, there's lots of scenes where blacks are doing auditions and they're told to act more black. Did that ever happen to you?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was... For me, Hollywood was when I realized that I wasn't black enough. It was like, here I am, a guy born and raised in the projects of New York City from a family of 10 children. I go to Tuskegee Institute in Alabama. I go to Los Angeles and audition, and they tell my agent, well, he wasn't black enough. And I go, boy, I can't see getting any blacker than this, you know. So I didn't understand that. But what I learned was that they were speaking in terms of the, not the reality of being black, but what Hollywood portrays as being black. And I never had enough of that to get particular roles that I'm glad I didn't get. I've been fortunate that most of the parts that I've gotten have just been regular people. You know, I didn't play the thugs and the pimps or slave stuff. I never got those. I was never black enough.
Did anyone ever give you directions on how to be more black?
Oh, sure. I had a director scream at me to bug my eyes out more.
Really?
And as the camera was pushing into my face, and he kept screaming, more eyes, more eyes, more eyes. And I just had to stop and say, hey, you know, my eyes can't get no bigger than this. You know, I don't know what it is you expect from me, but I can't do that.
Now, you co-wrote Hollywood Shuffle and co-starred in it. How is that film seen in Hollywood now? Is that seen as a success, and do you think that that's helping to open doors?
It's definitely seen as a success, both critically and financially. For the Goldwyn Studios, and also image-wise for the Goldwyn Studios, it you know, makes them seem like innovators and renegades, and so it helps, you know, that helps the prestige of a studio as well. When you have a small film do well, you know, especially a film like that, where most people wouldn't have taken a chance on that, it really makes, you know, like I said, makes the studio look good, and. Anytime you do that, everyone wants to follow suit. Everyone wants to look good, too. So it does open doors for the next crop of filmmakers like myself to come along and get their projects done. And the success of this film will open doors for others as well.
Thanks so much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Kenan Ivory Wayans' film I'm Gonna Get You, Sucka and Hollywood Shuffle are both out on video. This is the audition scene from Hollywood Shuffle.
Anyway, after getting my degree from the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art, I decided to come to Hollywood and do some movies.
Good. Why don't you start with the speech? That's very interesting.
Sure. Okay. Let me see. I ain't afraid of you. What is happening with your cool vines?
Thank you. Thank you. That
You're was... the worst actor I've ever seen in my life. I have to be frank with you.
I could do it in iambic.
You be messing with the wrong dude, bro.
Thank you. I got it. Nice. Thank you.
Thank you.
Very nice.
Did you like it?
Very much.
This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel is with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Robert.
Hi, Terry. Today we're going to be finding out what we can about Representative Mickey Leland of Texas, who's been missing now for 3 days. In Ethiopia. No word on what's become of him. Also, news from the Middle East, latest in the hostage crisis, nothing breaking. We'll be hearing from Ann Cooper about the town of Spitak in Armenia and how slow the pace of recovery has been since the devastating Armenian earthquake of late last year. And we'll also be hearing about plans for a new, presumably major, baseball league that would be competing with the American and National Leagues.
Thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Every once in a while, something comes along that grabs the American imagination and pocketbook at the same time. Everywhere commentator Patricia McLaughlin looks this summer, she sees bats.
I was picking up some milk at the corner store last night when I noticed, right there beside the cash register, a cute little cardboard display of Batman air fresheners. Is this necessary? Is this any kind of improvement on the little cardboard pine trees my grandfather used to dangle from the radio knob in his Studebaker? Of course, it's not only air fresheners. Millions of Americans are walking around with bats on their T-shirts this summer, or somebody's tonsils, depending on how you look at it. You can get Batman lapel pins, mugs, baseball caps, jackets, wristwatches, bike shorts. But why would you want to? In the old days, Joan Crawford would wear a dress in a movie, and the next week 10,000 women would want one just like it, and 7th Avenue would scramble to churn out copies. Kind of the way some people wanted Harrison Ford hats after the first Indiana Jones movie. Warner Brothers didn't wait around to see if Batman would generate any fads on its own. And no wonder. Was anybody really going to fall in love with Jack Nicholson's purple suits? Or his screaming orange satin shirts? Not to mention Michael Keaton's exceptionally silly-looking cape and those dopey ears. But what fun is it to have a blockbuster movie if you can't use it to sell anything? Seeing a movie as a marketing opportunity isn't exactly new. There were Glinda dolls after The Wizard of Oz came out, and the Reese's Pieces in E.T. and the famous Pepsi sequence in Top Gun. Too bad Orson Welles didn't think of it. Citizen Kane could have sold a million sleds. But Batman takes the interpenetration of marketing and entertainment to new heights, to the point that you can't anymore tell which is which. Long before the movie was finished, Warner Brothers had started licensing Batman stuff, and 140 different licensees started churning it out. They expect to sell $500 million worth of the stuff by the end of the year, which right there is more than most movies gross. The Batman trinkets are a triumph of shameless hype, like the movie itself. It was the sheer quantity of pre-release publicity that made it a must-see. By the time it came out, you'd heard so much about it that it didn't matter whether it was a great movie or not. You had to see it anyway. Missing it, even waiting for it to come out on video, would be like sleeping through an earthquake or missing a total eclipse. And I guess that's why people feel they have to have the tonsil T-shirt and the air freshener, too. It's a way to belong, a way to be current, a way to be part of your times. Batman's hot, and you've got him right there on your chest. It's awful to say, but dumb as the avalanche of Batman stuff is, we should probably be grateful for it. There's so little consensus in this country anymore. We're all splinters and factions. Neo-Nazi skinheads and weirdo survivalists and plutocrats and oat-brand fanatics and channelers and deadheads and the people who think Jesse Helms is right and the people who think he's a nutcase and the people who think Pete Rose did it and the people who think he didn't. It's only when something like this comes along, something totally synthetic and ridiculous and hype-driven like the Super Bowl or Batman, that millions of us find something we can all get into and be part of and share for long enough to, just momentarily, have something in common. Maybe it's better than nothing.
Patricia McLaughlin is a syndicated columnist who writes about style for the Philadelphia Inquirer magazine. Amy Salad and Phyllis Myers produce the interviews on Fresh Air. Our research interns are Hilary Goldhammer, Liz Trubert, and Marco Cathoria, who returns to graduate school today. Thanks and good luck, Marco. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the trivializing of the presidential elections with political writers Jack Drummond and Jules Whitcover. Their new book looks at how the presidential campaign has gone from a debate on the issues to a collection of sound bites and photo opportunities. They use last year's race as a case study. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.